Okay, everyone, if you take your seats, we're going to get going. You will have heard the initials SSN mentioned in the last session. I'm just going to explain very quickly what that means. It's just a working name for something called a subject specialist network. Some people will remember the Committee for National Photographic Collections that effectively ground to a halt in the early 2000s. An SSN, a subject specialist network, is a kind of reconsideration of a network that starts from collections but explores advocacy and development as well. Sorry to use jargon, but it's the idea of knowledge exchange, expertise exchange, talking around what happens to collections, and also from that advocacy and the development of the collections and other subjects that those sorts of specialists working in photography will talk about. So the idea is to start up a network like that, and we're working on it right now. Red Eye's got the initial go-ahead, and we've got all the people who are on stage plus some other partners working on that now. So watch this space. It's very exciting, actually, and it could form a small part of what we might decide to do at the end of today. I'm going to, without further ado, introduce Sarah Fisher, who's going to talk from her perspective, yes, as the director of OpenEye Gallery in Liverpool, but also as, if it's fair to say, a strategist in the arts, working for the Arts Council across a range of different areas. So, over to you, Sarah. Thank you very much. Welcome.
Okay. Thanks. So, it's been brilliant to come here because it's firstly because to meet everybody from the photography sector. I don't come from the photography sector. I come from a kind of broader visual arts, contemporary arts, and I'm just agog at everybody's expertise. And I think that goes across the board, actually. So, it's been completely amazing coming here, and I will borrow all of your expertise at some point in the near future. I'm just slipping that in now. When I first got the opportunity to take on OpenEye, I love photography, so that was fantastic for me. But I kind of thought, how amazing photography, because photography is where it's at, basically. And it's interesting listening to everybody speak at the moment, because there's a sort of sense of a worry about how we go forward. But I just think now's the time, actually, to start to think collectively about how we go forward. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the potential for a distributed national something. But I'm also going to just put it in a kind of broader context. So this could be very boring. So if you find it very, very boring, try not to look like you're going to sleep, because it will be really upsetting for me. Okay, this is Daniel Miller. He's an anthropologist. He's written various things, including anthropology. It's photography in the age of Snapchat. This particular text suggests, as many people have said, suggests that photography is the most important medium in terms of how we understand ourselves because it's shared. Somebody sort of said that there's 1.5 million or whatever shared images or uploaded images a day. It's actually nearer 2 billion now per day. And I think it's really important that's where we start. We start with photography. I think the issue of collections, the issue of development, all come underneath that sense of what are we doing for photography? Because collectively, we're doing a lot for photography. Individually, we all have our own institutional imperatives, I suppose. So I just want to talk a little bit about this, because if you notice the circle at the top, the economic dimension, that's where all the money is, let's be real. And the language that they use within that within the economic dimension is quite different to the language we use within the cultural dimension. But interestingly, photography does hit right the way across the board, particularly if you look at advertising at the moment, or you put advertising and photography into Google, what will come up is a million people talking about how they use the photograph because of social media. And what's the kind of strength of the photograph in relation to social media? I've got to be really quick because I've been told I'll be killed if I go over my 10 minutes. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the opportunity context at the moment. We all know that we're shuffling less money, and we all know that there is a geographic imperative in terms of There's a number of papers. There's a culture, media, and sport committee at the moment looking at whether too much money is going into the capital, which we're obviously all aware of. There's a big devolution agenda, and there's huge opportunities for photography within that. And we think about city regions and what they could or could be, and how we embed photography into the thinking in terms of localism. Obviously, I'm going to talk about the Northern Powerhouse, which is a sort of very vague thing in terms of anything actually happening. But there's a need for the Tory government to actually invest something in the North. And, you know, they chucked money at the Manchester Initiative, in part because that's what was put before them. Let's be really frank about that. That got to George Osborne, and George Osborne came up with 78 million or whatever it was for that initiative. I think we need to think about pragmatically now. It's really important that we all come together, think pragmatically, and think about what we can actually get into photography. The second context is the diversity context. You'll have read the incredibly riveting culture white paper. That's a quote from our friend, David Cameron. But I think it's important to say that the sorts of things that are being said within that paper are being said, have been said, through a number of different papers. So Warwick Report, obviously. There's a big sort of conversation about the dip, and certainly in terms of the Nationals as an example, it's the worst dip in terms of lower socioeconomic groups visiting the Nationals, a dip of 12% in that period. But the thinking within that paper is that the mismatch is actually to do with the difference between the public's taste and what's offered in terms of the public offer. Yeah, it's important to think about that, because actually photography could well hold a lot of the potential solutions to that problem, because people are using it and people are already involved in it. Then the other one is thinking about that crossover, so the Creative Industries Federation and others that are looking at the crossover between the cultural sector and the creative industries. Whatever the problematics are within these agendas, I think it's probably not the point to dwell on the problematics, but actually to seize the potential for photography within these agendas. So almost ignore the fact that there's questionable, I suppose, some sort of questionable thinking in the Creative Industries Federation's agenda. But ignoring that, how do we get photography into the centre of it? Because they're having quite a significant voice at the moment in terms of policy. Education, we haven't talked a lot about education. I think it's a mistake to see this conversation just about collections. I think it's about everything that happens with photography, and education is one of the biggest questions for all of us, actually, is the relationship that photography has and how embedded that is within education. And that goes right the way through, from the sort of STEAM agenda to the new cultural education partnerships. I mean, how much work are we putting into those at the moment as a sector, and can we actually develop a voice for those new partnerships, to the sort of apprenticeship schemes. I've been very involved in the university and cultural sector partnerships, particularly across the North. And also, when we look at the research agenda, again, there is an amazing wealth of knowledge. And I've met a number of people now whose main area of research in universities is dedicated to photography. So the question is, can we bring those agendas together, I think? And then looking, is the Arts Council in here? Yes. Okay. Arts Council. Close your eyes a minute. But I think basically in the conversations that I've had with the Arts Council, and I think the Arts Council has to move towards a kind of cultural council. It may not call itself a cultural council, but because it's bringing museums into the portfolio next time round, and because of the push to work more closely with HLF, and all of the conversations about the value of arts and culture, and most of you will have seen the stuff that AHRC did on this over the last couple of years. It's interesting, in the briefing that we had with the Arts Council, there's a number of things that came up that were different to previously thought of. One of which, for example, was recognising broader cultural forms and how to support broader cultural forms. Photography's always there's always been this sort of question, what's art photography? Gets funded by the Arts Council. And then there's things like documentary photography. Now, most of us, photography galleries, have always done both. And most museums have always done both, in social photography and photography in different ways. I think the move and the changes within the Arts Council will actually allow more funding to trickle through to these different kind of forms of development, and should do too. So I'm just thinking about what we've got. Now, this is a very naive sense of what we've got, but I think we've got an infrastructure with sort of pockets of specialism, and individually, we're quite modest in scale. So I think, with greatest respect to the photography experts within the V&A and also within the Science Museum, you guys are specialists that have an incredible amount of knowledge but maybe don't hold the whole power for the V&A because it's got a larger institutional, and the same for you, Michael. I think collectively, though, we do. If we could come together and push collectively, and we were thinking across the piece, we were thinking about collections, we were thinking about the kinds of activity that gets funded by the Arts Council, we were thinking about what's happening in universities, et cetera, et cetera. Collectively, we could have a huge amount of clout. So I think we need to think about this broader context for opportunity, and then I think we need to think about innovation. So we're where we are. I personally, this is a provocation. I think a building at the moment is unlikely for photography. I also question whether it's right to develop another building. My suggestion is that we come together and we agree areas of necessity within, and instead of pushing for something like a building, because I don't think it's the climate to do it, we push for something like an endowment fund. If you think about what the Art Fund's done in terms of collecting, or you think about what certain agencies have done where they have had money in terms of developing particular sectors, my suggestion would be, rather than pushing for a building, that we actually look at the specialisms and the expertise that we've got across the board in terms of photography, and we push for some kind of endowment fund within using those contexts that I sort of suggested earlier, that I skated through incredibly badly, but using those. And then we think about what would this kind of distributed, I don't know what to call it. I've said institute, but I'm not sure. We need some kind of foundation where the funding brings other funding. So, you know, I think it's very interesting what the V&A is doing in terms of that, the model to develop curators outside of London. Again, the money helps. Having some money to actually put into that is the thing that actually makes it happen. And if you think about what's happened with the Art Fund, it's a fantastic fund in that it's enabled museums and galleries across the country to collect. And then there's other pots of money that have enabled institutions to do development work, et cetera, et cetera. I think we need to try and talk to the existing funders, but also to generate interest in another fund coming our way, to actually look at all of these things. If we had a National Museum of Photography, could it be a distributed one? Could we agree on even small collections that might exist in quite obscure places as being nationally significant? If we were looking at learning and research network, which I think is what you're talking about in terms of the SNN? Yeah, SSN? Yes. Can we actually think about how we pull that in so we make sure that it does cover development work as well? So I think it came out of collections, but I would stress that just thinking about collections seems an odd model. There's at Salford University, there's a very active, interesting person who is developing a collection for the university, and she basically works with organisations like us to commission to collect for the university. And I think what's interesting about that model is that it enables the development work to happen, as well as works to be accessioned into her collection. Now, it may not be the right model for everyone, and I'm sure it's not going to happen, but I think we need to think about what we're collecting now. And I think the amount of free money to actually collect stuff now is pretty slight. And then the other thing is about some kind of agency role. So money always acts as an agent, doesn't it? There's anyone that's got any money, if you watch a big group of people in a building and there's somebody that's got some money and then there's people like me, we'll just be making a beeline for those person, you know, straight away. So I kind of think we need a pot of money. We need a pot of money that actually develops it. And if you put a case forward for a building, I think perhaps today we could think about, is that the right model? Could we put a case forward for a Endowment Pot. I've got to stop, haven't I? So just quickly, a distributed national, so we have some kind of endowment fund. We've got a very small team that's kind of coordinating. So a very, very small revenue need, if you like, for this thing. But the activity needs to relate to those outward-facing goals. When I was talking about those contexts that are current, if we can have people that are just thinking about outward-facing goals so that we can pull more money into the endowment. And then we have this institute where we agree people who are very, very key and pivotal across the country to photography become members, and so they're able to bid into the fund. This is my suggestion. It is just a suggestion, and it may not be the right one. That's it. Thanks.
Gosh, lots to think about. Thank you very much, Sarah. I'm going to move straight on to Frances Hodgson, a professor in the culture of photography at the University of Brighton, who's going to reflect on his thoughts around a model that could work. Is that right, or are you going to talk about something else? No, no.
Can I sit here? You don't have slides to show?
Yeah, sure you can. Well, you can talk about what you like, Frances, so long as you stick to the time.
Probably should have spoken before Sarah, because I'm very glad to hear some of the things Sarah's thinking about going beyond the particular question which has brought us here, which is about one particular collection and what happens to it. Originally, Paul, you asked me to talk a bit about the history. I have very long memories about these things, and I've been looking at the photographic world for a long time. It goes without saying that this latest kerfuffle about the collection moving from one place to another is the latest in a long line of mismanagement of the National Photographic Holdings. Call it a distributed collection, if you like, or not. How far back do you want to go? You start with poor Mr. Helmut Gernsheim, who tried to give what was then the best collection in the world, give for free to the nation, and we thought, well, does it go to the National Trust? Does it go to the V&A? Does it go to X and Y? At one point, there was a building in Austerlitz that was going to be given to him. And the long and the short of this story is that Mr. Gernsheim was a difficult man. He was also a Jew. And that, by and large, it was made pretty plain to him that the nation didn't want his stuff. That's late 50s, early 60s. I forget the date of the transfer. There's a wonderful Granada television program explaining what happened to the Gernsheim collection. It eventually went to a great, great museum collection in the United States, and it's the foundation of one of the greatest research cultural institutes that there is. We simply turned our back on it. More recently, I mean, you know, we talk about national museums of photography, making individual buildings, Sarah's talking about. I'm old enough to remember a very pressing lobbying campaign to turn that lovely building at the end of Cork Street into a national museum of photography. It was then the Museum of Mankind building. There was a quite serious attempt to say, right at the end of the art world's favourite drag, let's have a museum. That failed. There was a former grammar school on Carlton Hill in Edinburgh, again, a lovely building, purpose-built. It could have been a national museum of photography. We turned our back on that. We have, without going to too great length, we have a long catalogue of institutional false starts about how we treat photography. Colin was talking earlier about the foundation of the Photographers' Gallery in 1971. Photographers' Gallery could easily have become a collections-holding institution, and indeed at one point Sue Davis was very keen that it should become a collections-holding institute. But her partner at that time, the director of the Board of Trustees, was Margaret Harker, who was deeply loyal to the Royal Photographic Society and who scotched the idea there should be a new or perhaps a more contemporary collection. So, as I say, I'm aware of lots and lots of false starts. I don't necessarily think that the four middle-aged white gentlemen that we saw here should take the blame for the latest imbroglio that's going on. I look around and I think it's been a long, long time that there's been no national policy about photography. There's only ever been one single holder of the Arts Council post of photography officer, Barry Lane, who many of you will remember. And Barry did a sterling job of speaking on behalf of the whole thing, as trying to talk for all sorts of practitioners. And that's gone. Photography remains essentially a series of interconnected cottage industries. It's not like other media or other art forms in that there is one core, and you can say that people are in it if they're interested in needlework or in sculpture. They are within the... There are, of course, lots of photographic activities which turn their back on each other. That's one of the reasons we like it so much. It's huge. It's broad. Clearly, that makes it difficult to address questions of policy, and it always has done, and it's always been true. I mean, I've heard many, many distinguished commercial photographers who say, V&A, what's that? I never use it. It's not part of my life. They live their life using sources and research materials from elsewhere. You can't do much about that if you want photography still to be as broad as it is, and that's fine. You know, I see here Hilary Roberts, who is in charge, I believe, of the largest national collection of photographs, because there's a statute that says that whatever it is, 40 embedded photographers in the armed forces used to send in rolls of film, and now they send in hard drives. And Hilary can tell us that she's become a world expert in dealing with digital materials far in excess of any skills she was expected to have. Of course, we've heard people saying that museum culture has to move on, and this is one example among many, but there has been a total absence of public policy. Now, in the recent debate about the Royal Photographic Society collection, it seems to me that the policy questions were the ones which should have been addressed first. First thing I have to say is it seems to me completely wrong, I mean actually morally wrong, for the discussion about what is actually the largest collection of photographs in the country to be dismissed in any one holding. For that to take place as an internal discussion among museum professionals without consultation of the kind that we've heard today taking place in advance seems to me a mistake. Just that, just a mistake. It was a wrong way of proceeding. The Science Museum Group felt that it was, as you know, I mean, museum disposals go on all the time. Don't have any illusions about that. And they take place quietly. There are professional discussions that need to take place, and that's quite proper. But not, I think, for one of the key collections in the country. I think some kind of politicians being accountable for that decision, some kind of public voice being heard in that decision would have been appropriate for a collection of that magnitude and so important in the cultural wealth of the nation. None of that took place. Essentially, the disposal of that collection would have taken place in secret had people not got upset and tense and excited about it as they did. And I'm glad they did. It means that we're having these kind of conversations now. You might say, well, is that transfer in fact a done deal? You heard these gentlemen this morning talking about it as though it were. As a matter of strict legal fact, I don't think it is. I think it's possible to question two aspects of it, and it may be necessary to question those aspects in the future. One is to do with purchase. The RPS collection was actually purchased, somebody mentioned the figure, 3.75 million from the Heritage Lottery Fund. And there are guidelines, although I don't believe they're legally enforceable guidelines, that say that if financial value was paid for museum assets, then financial value must be sought for the disposal of museum assets. And we've heard today, we know that it's a fact, the V&A is being given the RPS collection, and is not producing even nominal value for it. That seems to me the grounds for a legal question, at least. I don't necessarily at all say that one should get up in arms and ask that question legally, but I don't think you can say the transfer is a done deal until a satisfactory resolution to that question has been found. Yorkshire Forward, which was the Yorkshire Development Agency, no longer exists. They produce some money. Heritage Lottery Fund and the Art Fund, which wasn't called that in the... Monies were found. Actually, of course, in the nature of these things, the sum of money was just under 5 million sterling at the time. It was a huge undervaluing of the proper market value of the collection, but leave that aside. What you had was a transfer for value. What you have now is a transfer as a gift. Those aren't equal in museum policy. Then we've had lots of talk of betrayal, and I think that's overexcited language. I mean, the two betrayals that I've heard discussed, one is a betrayal of the North, because far more money is spent by the Arts Council and DCMS on cultural activity in the south per head than it is in the north. If you deprive the north of one of its great collections, that is emphasizing that distinction. Clearly, politically, that's a very, very difficult problem. The other is the betrayal of photography itself, which is a phrase that I wrote about the other day, but I think you all see the shorthand that I'm referring to. Clearly, if you have a national museum of photography, and you then call it a national media museum, and it's in its new incarnation, it never even begins to open a collection in any new medium other than the ones it already had, something very peculiar has gone on. It seems to me quite overt that in 2006, the museum moved its focus away from collections and artifacts and the previously existing culture of photography, film, and television to something much more experiential, and that hasn't worked. My belief is that was also a mistake, and I haven't seen anybody even begin to be held accountable for that. That's a mistake. It's not mine to ascribe blame. But I think one can make an argument that if you say, I mean, let me remind you, for those who don't know, let me tell you, that at the time the National Media Museum was being so renamed and its focus was changing, the British Library got 40 million sterling to start collecting media. And the British Library has quietly but relatively successfully started to hurdle all the problems you can imagine. How do you collect websites? How do you collect radio programs? How do you collect blogs? These are intractable problems for museology. They're very difficult to deal with. But the British Library is miles, miles ahead down that road of anything the Media Museum has been, in my coarse language, bothered to try and achieve since it turned its focus. So there are problems of the previous supply, in terms of the national holdings of photography. As I say, I'm very grateful that today's discussion has been a calm and forward-looking one, because I've been on this platform before when tempers have got heated and people have ascribed blame. There's not much sense in ascribing blame, but I don't think one can look at the transaction that's taken place and simply say, it's happened, it's all for the best. The custodians of the national holdings in photography have done the right thing. I'm not at all sure that they have. And I'm sure it's absolutely appropriate to base one's thinking on some sense of coming to a value judgment of where we are, how we got there, as well as to some forward-looking thinking. And Sarah's just given you an excellent example of positive, ambitious, daring, quite brave, perfectly achievable forward thing. There are others too, of course there are. So, in the history of these things, you start looking around and you start thinking, well, we've talked a little bit about education, and of course we can talk about commercial practice, which never gets talked about in these kind of circumstances. We can talk about what the RPS was in 1900, and these are big, big historical weights that give some definition to what the practical collections are now. On the other side, you can start talking about what might be or what should be done. But at the key, at the core of all of this, I repeat, only one ever photography officer at the Arts Council. That seems to me incredible. Two, the Museums, Libraries and Arts Council disappears, and the problem that we see before us happens within, in museum terms, within minutes of that happening. The National Museum of Film, Photography and Television, in historical terms, is very young. It seems to me extraordinary that, without mincing words, it's already quite blatantly under threat of closure, as though individual political whims, individual political wins should simply raise or dismiss a museum in that kind of way. The director of the National Museums Group the other day was perfectly plain. He said, one of the outstations will have to close. The only likely candidate for that, let's be quite blunt, is the Bradford Museum. So one looks at this going on. One looks at the kind of shape. Individual decisions, as I say, these gentlemen are not responsible for the total absence of public policy about the thing. And what I'm going to say, Paul, I know that I haven't got very much time. It's a very simple thing. We need to ask for policy, even though photography is so broad that no policy can in practice treat with all of photography. Because I, for one, and I dare say lots of you, are now tired of policy changing and then changing back again, of being absent and only a brave and daring and courageous individual makes a difference. And there are lots of people who've bravely said, we'll make a museum of photography, we'll make the Photographer's Gallery in London, we'll do this or that or the other, but always in this total absence of political will. My own feeling, if you want an act of belief to drop on the table in front of you all, photography is by far the most important means of communication that we have. It's also key to every art practice that we have. I suppose I'd say that it's dwindling slightly from its position of preeminence for various reasons, but that between 1950 and 2000, photography was the culture of us all. And to have no public policy about that, but to leave individual curators or the head of the Royal Photographic Society or brave fundraisers to make those decisions tant bien que mal themselves seems to me to be wrong. And the experience of the history that we have before us shows that it hasn't worked. And that's all I really want to say, is we've been here before. I have no doubt that the V&A will, if they're allowed to continue with it, do very well with this great new addition to their holdings. But I'm not sure it was the right way to come to that next step in the provision of maintenance and care and the gain of profit from the national holdings in photography. Thank you.